Hi, everyone. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about a pair of movies, a double feature, if you will, for about an hour. And this week, our double feature is Halloween. You know, and I know what you're thinking. You know, we missed the boat on this one. No, the second feature is The Day After Halloween. And if you're listening to this the day that it comes out, it well, it's not quite the day after Halloween. It's the day after the day
after. The day
after, But The Day After Halloween was not filmed as that. It's an Australian thriller. I'll use that word generously. And they retitled it in America to try to cash in on Halloween, which is ridiculous. But we'll get to that. But, oh, and Halloween, you know, we didn't just watch the theatrical cut. We watched a harder-to-find TV cut with some extra scenes in it. And, you know, let's not waste any time describing Halloween. Everybody knows what it is.
Yeah.
Just before we started recording, you were saying, like, you know, you forgot what the TV cut scenes do to the movie. So explain.
Well, okay, so the TV cut is, the story behind the TV cut is in, I guess, 80 or so, because Halloween 2 was 81. So in 80, they wanted to air Halloween on a network. Except Halloween runs 91 minutes, so it probably runs more like 90 minutes and 34 seconds or something, which is not enough for commercial breaks in a two-hour time slot. So John Carpenter was producing Halloween 2 at the time, and he's like, fine, I'll shoot some additional scenes. And so he was able to, because, you know, he had Donald Pleasance and Jamie Lee Curtis, he was able to shoot some additional scenes. What he also was able to do was he was able to get back Nancy Loomis or Nancy Keys. I can never figure out if she's... It's Keys now, but I don't know if it was always Keys. I mean, it's weird. She doesn't have a good bio, but Nancy Loomis or Nancy Loomis at the time, who was in Halloween, she was in Assault on Precinct 13. She was basically in all of Carpenter's really good movies except The Thing. She was in Assault on Precinct 13, Halloween, The Fog, and then she was in... She wasn't in Halloween 2. Oh, yes, she was. Her body showed up in Halloween 2 for a shot, didn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. And then she was in Halloween 3, I believe, as Tom Atkins' ex-wife or something. And then she sort of fell off the face of the earth.
That's a whole other angle of weirdness to Halloween 3. But anyways,
so, yeah. Yeah, she came back, and so did PJ Souls, who was famouser at that point, right?
Yeah, and you know what? There actually were some TV scenes. The reason, like, I think they were willing to throw money at creating extra scenes and bringing back actors and stuff, and even bringing back Carpenter, is because, like, Universal. Well, it was airing on, like, NBC,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah, and they're owned by Universal, or Universal's owned by
them.
Not then, no. There are some, like, films of that time that would have additional scenes for the TV broadcast, and it wasn't all that uncommon.
It wasn't uncommon. The only uncommon thing, and I can't think of any other example of this, of returning to it and filming stuff during the sequel that would be inserted into the first film. I don't think anybody else ever did anything like this. I remember... God, what was it? X-Men 2, there were rumors that they were going to do that. They were going to film stuff to release an extended version of the first one when they had the cast reunited. But what I meant by it changes the movie is that it's 12 minutes of new scenes. And 12 minutes of new scenes on a 90-minute movie, significant, especially since most of them are at the beginning, and two very long ones... they're all very long. I mean, they're longer than they need to be. The Jamie Lee Curtis scene has PJ Souls coming over to borrow a shirt for her date. And then, you know, it's kind of funny because you can tell it's still Deborah Hill writing the girls.
Yeah.
But then Jamie Lee Curtis goes over to the window and sings that song that she sang when she's walking home.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of like... It's not like she's a good singer, so they really couldn't have thought of any other way to pad it. And then I thought of a really good way they could have padded it, but I'll bring that up later. But then the other scenes are Donald Pleasance. It's like 8 minutes of Donald Pleasance. And it changes the dynamic of the movie because Donald Pleasance was originally in the movie for 16 minutes. So they added a third of his time on. So you're like, where'd Donald Pleasance go? Well, he didn't go anywhere. He's not supposed to be in the movie, but you're expecting him because he was in the beginning so much.
Yeah. Yeah, it I don't think any of that stuff really hurts it. In fact, I dare say I think it only adds to it, especially because these scenes are not forced to be cropped for television. Carpenter filmed them widescreen,
yeah.
And eventually, you know, we have this version that has them put back in there. I'm sure Donald Pleasance was happier about it because it justifies his top billing a little more. But, like, it does add a different rhythm to the movie. I mean, it has been a while since I've watched Halloween last, but I do remember enough about the rhythm that, yeah, it becomes a little less terse and a little more, like, languid because all the extra stuff is in the first half of the movie before Michael Myers really kills anyone as an adult, and he's mostly just creeping all over the place while they're setting up, you know, the night of the babysitting. I'd forgotten that the whole movie takes place in one day, by the way.
Yeah.
Or I never noticed it before and how cool that is. But I don't think it hurts the mood of the film and its strengths. I mean, you know, because the scenes that they shot and inserted in there, what I was afraid of is that because in Halloween 2 they decided that he was going to be Jamie Lee Curtis's sister, they didn't have Michael Myers I thought they were going to show that in the TV cut.
Well,
and they didn't. All they do is have him write sister
on
the door. But you can kind of accept that.
You can
that
take that as, two ways,
like,
yeah.
You know, he's fixated on his sister, which, you know, an attentive viewer would notice anyway. He's repeating the pattern of murdering his sister. He's got some kind of, you know, fixation on that.
And
none of it like diminished the movie, which is what I was afraid of. I actually quite like the scene where PJ Souls comes over to borrow the clothes and Jamie Lee Curtis and isn't the third girl on
yeah
like,
Nancy
in the
Keys
scene
is on
too.
The phone yeah. And that's always been
so it feels like a real director's cut, oddly enough, instead of just like scenes that were filmed and stuck in later. Because
it does, yeah. Even
the first
when it's
the first scene, but like it looks about as cheaply shot as, you know, the original Halloween was cheaply shot, because it's just Donald Pleasance in a big like university lecture hall with two doctors at a table in front, and it's all dialogue scene.
Yeah, and it makes the movie more about the psychology of Michael Myers, which is weird. And I guess I've always just been cynical about it because I've always assumed that the sister thing on the wall was meant to be Jamie Lee Curtis. And that's what bugged me this time was, is if it is meant to be Jamie Lee Curtis, and I mean, that's assuming Carpenter is pulling a George Lucas or something.
It kind of is like an early horror version of that. Yeah.
So,
like bridging. If it came out today, it would be like the 1.5.
Yeah, exactly. But my issue with it is that Donald Pleasance should have known. I never thought about this. Donald Pleasance would have known about Jamie Lee Curtis in the sequel.
Yeah.
And I can't remember in Halloween 2 if he comments on it, but he would have known about this because we have all this groundwork. The new scenes add all this. Donald Pleasance is his psychiatrist. Donald Pleasance, you know, has been working with him, been working with the family, et cetera, et cetera. So he would know that there was the sister out there who got adopted out or whatever the hell happens to her. They never really explain her adoption well in the second one.
Yeah, I was afraid there were going to be scenes like in the second one where Laurie Strode is dreaming of being a little girl and, you know, little Michael won't talk to her like they had in Halloween 2.
But you notice that's the same little Michael in that room when he goes in and sees
it. It is,
yeah.
There's so much. Boy, there was so much planning between these two movies. I mean, Universal really stepped in and.
Yeah,
you know,
Universal really helped them out.
Voted all their resources to exploiting the name, the
and
franchise.
That's like one of the things about it is that we've talked about this. I think you know, it's John Carpenter's only made one movie since we started doing the podcast. And so I think in the first, when we did our Carpenter two-parter, we mentioned that you read interviews with Carpenter. He's like, I could make movies, but I'm too busy playing video games. And also, like, The Fog, he's like, I don't care if people make crappy remakes of my movies as long as the check clears. And when you see this scene, you're like, you know, they were like, hey, you want to shoot some more scenes? And he was like, you gonna pay me for them? I don't care. Sure. Which is, of course, how, you know, I sort of envision he reacts to Halloween 2 overall.
I love his anecdote. It's not even an anecdote. It's just like, you know, asked about the brother-sister thing. He was like, well, I was up all night, you know, with a six-pack, and that was the best I had.
Yeah,
he says as much.
So I feel like... So you watched it without feeling like it was too much tied to the second one. I've watched it feeling like it was, and then it loses any logic, the first one does, when you think about it as a true prequel of the second one or whatever, because why the hell is Michael stalking Laurie's friends?
I guess you just have to believe he did it to scare her. Like,
or something,
the placement of the gravestone and, you know, having a body fall out of a drawer,
you know,
or whatever.
It's the Luke and Leia kiss, right? It's not really actually supposed to be like that, but, you know, what are you going to do? It's not worth debating because it was never supposed to be like that.
But actually, you know what? I noticed this time. One of the really scary things about the movie actually is it does suggest that he chooses Laurie totally arbitrarily, because the first time you see him when he's mm-hmm. out of the asylum is inside the old Myers house, and she walks up to the front porch, and you see the POV of him looking at
her,
and then he steps outside and watches her leave, and it's like he's selected his target.
Exactly, and the little kid.
Yeah, and the little kid, right. He also immediately is, like, driving alongside outside the kid's school.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about it when I was watching it, and this is something I've never noticed before. There's the huge, glaring Psycho reference in the opening scene when little Michael kills his sister. Have you ever noticed this?
I'm trying to think of what it is, but no, what is it?
The POV shot, Michael enters through the kitchen, goes through, you see Deborah Hill's little hand. Then he goes through the living room, and you see a rocking chair in the window rocking.
No, I never noticed
that. I know, and I'm like, I've seen this movie 7 or 8 times, and I've never noticed this before. And it's like, it's really obvious. It's like, why is the chair rocking? And it's because mother was there, and, you know, it's like...
yeah.
And I feel like that's one of the great gifts of great Carpenter is that, you know, you never run out with Carpenter. But, yeah, I mean, he picks these three people, and I feel like... I was reading the trivia, and of course, Halloween, the original script title, was The Babysitter Murders.
Right, that was Irwin Yablons's brainstorm of an idea.
Well, that was the dispute, is whether or not he came up with that title, or if he came up with Halloween.
Well, from what I understand, reading Shock Value, which is a really good recent book published about the horror filmmakers of the 70s and onto 80s and late 60s, but, like... Irwin Yablons had the Babysitter Murders idea. Carpenter thought, you know, let's call it Halloween and take advantage of that. And Carpenter had seen, like, Bob Clark's Black Christmas,
mm-hmm.
and you know, he felt he could do something similar. I mean, you can't totally say that, you know, it's just a straight lift of Black Christmas, but, you know, certain elements.
Yeah, but...
The heavy use of point of view, perhaps especially.
And that's something that Carpenter's actually credited with basically inventing in the horror genre, which up until the late 90s, because I was in a film class once and I made that comment, and the professor's like, mm-hmm. he didn't mention Black Christmas, but he's like, have you ever seen The Hill? The Sidney Lumet movie. He's like, have you ever seen that? It's like, all the gas mask shots running through. Yeah, it wasn't new. And I was like, well, know, I was.
And also, I mean, maybe there are even some other examples for horror movies, but the idea of like putting you in the place of the killer was pretty new when it was used by Bob Clark. But like the Michael Myers character also is the other great original addition to the movie, and that was Carpenter. And, you know, that's like a character that you take for granted now because it became a template for a kind of identityless killer with a mask, where the mask is the identity, and that leads to, you know, Jason and a million other movies like it.
But it was
a really, really original kind of idea of an antagonist at the time.
I think we had mentioned this when we weren't recording last month, that maybe we should have done, or no, I think we were emailing about it. Maybe we should have done the Rob Zombies. I almost feel like we need to do the Rob Zombies at some point. We're just going to crap on them. I mean, I think we need to do it just because, you know, I don't think of Halloween as one of Carpenter. I mean, it's, you know, I think he has three great movies, like just freaking outstanding ones. Halloween's not one of them for me, yet it's so clearly brilliantly made that I feel like we should do the Rob Zombies just to crap on them sometime. But the other thing is, and I'm sure you've read this, and I would have thought I would have read it too, is that the Michael Myers face reveal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Tony Moran.
Tony Moran.
One shot wonder in this movie.
The
gets to go horror conventions the rest of his career because of that shot.
He Carpenter said, you know, we didn't do any makeup to him except for the eye wound.
Yeah.
And everybody always thought he was somehow deformed. And this, I'm watching it this time, and I must have read that before sometime, and I still was like, ooh, he's a deformed guy.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty gory, you know, eye injury.
It is a pretty gory
eye makeup
injury.
For, or maybe it's just because you see it so quickly. But
and
yeah,
it's very, yeah, it's so brief. And yeah, so
it's interesting that they felt the need to show him somehow, or maybe that they were kind of playing on your expectations. Like, you think he's going to look stranger than he does, but aside from the eye, he's just some guy, and that's like a point, or you know, a surprise for the audience.
Well, I mean, this time I was so I just watched Assault on Precinct 13 a few weeks ago, which of course has the timeline for a while. It gives you the time to sort of bring you into the reality of the situation. So 5:45, 6:15.
Does that movie take place in a single day and night?
Of course it does. It's early Carpenter. So does The Fog.
Yeah.
So does Escape from New York.
Compressed timelines. And I'd forgotten, yeah, like I said, that Halloween takes place in a single day.
Well, I guess Halloween was originally supposed to take place over 3 days. And much like the original Fog that they talk about on the audio commentary.
Yeah.
You know, The Fog, apparently, they almost entirely reshot it because nobody liked. It almost sounded more like that Halloween 3 that he didn't get, or Halloween 4 that Carpenter never could convince anybody to do, where it was a town dealing with the repercussions of a Michael Myers attack or something. The Fog originally was supposed to be very implied, just absolutely no Rob Bottin is a leper ghost.
Yeah.
And so nobody's ever released it. I don't think anybody's ever released the script. I mean, it's like, I'd love to see what the script for the Halloween looks like taking place over 3 days, because there's so much implied. Carpenter and Deborah Hill imply so much. I mean, does Laurie Strode have a mom? We assume she does, but only because she never says anything otherwise. But we only see her dad for a second, and I don't think her mom's ever mentioned. In some ways, that's how they can get away with adding on family members whenever they feel like it in the sequel, is because nobody ever see, I mean,
like
the Ben Tramer part in this?
Michael. Yeah.
I'd forgotten that the dispute between Laurie and Nancy Loomis Keyes over Ben Tramer takes up about 7 minutes of screen time, and that's a lot of screen time in this long movie, in such a short movie. But the one thing that I thought that if they really wanted to explain a plot hole away, Lori drops off the keys to the Myers house so her dad can show the house.
Yeah.
We later learn that Michael was there. He ate a dog.
I love the idiosyncrasies in his behavior from the first movie that they never got anywhere near as creative with in any of the sequels.
Well, you can't beat it.
I mean, he ate a dog because he was hungry.
The second one sort of takes the whole compressed narrative. What is it? The second one probably takes place over, 3 hours? I mean, it's just a freaking disaster. I mean, you know, go listen to the audio commentary.
In the world's most desolate working hospital.
Yeah, go listen to our audio commentary on that one. Very popular, actually. But the dad would have showed the house when Michael was presumably actually he wasn't there because we know he was stalking.
He was out buying rope and
he was stalking the girls,
stalking
right?
kids and stuff. Yeah.
But wouldn't it have been a great scene?
He had a car.
Wouldn't it have been a great scene of the people touring the house?
Oh, and he's creeping around?
Well, either he's creeping around or he's not. I vaguely feel like they did the creeping around in, the one with Paul Rudd, maybe? The really crappy sequel. You haven't seen any of the sequels after...
No, I've seen, part of part 4 on TV once.
Yeah, so I feel like they did that once where somebody was in the house and he was creeping through it the whole time. But no, I mean, I just feel like... it would have been an amusing scene to fill in. And maybe then you could have gotten rid of the singing at the window. Because the singing at the window, the problem with that scene is...
No, but you know what, though? I liked that. And I liked that there's another scene in the movie where she's singing the same song because the song is some, corny old romantic tune. And... something I'd kind of forgotten or never noticed before that I was appreciating watching it this time around was the little subtle suggestions of Laurie and Michael fated to be in this duel, because that was part of even the theatrical cut before any thought of Halloween 2. It's when she's in the classroom. You can hear the teacher in the background talking about a Shakespearean play and the idea of fate and, do we choose our destiny or are we fated? And, cut to her looking out the window.
And there's Michael.
Nightmare on Elm Street actually kind of stole that scene now that I think about it. But, and humming her song, it also reminded me of was only with, more purpose, Sigourney Weaver singing "You Are My Lucky Star" to herself at the very end of Alien because she's so scared. Of course, it's a different circumstances
later,
in this, but
Scott,
I don't know. I like when characters in movies do things like that, things to themselves.
I agree with you, but my issue with the scene in question is that it's just too long, in my opinion. Because I get it. I get the reason for returning to it because it actually gets, when she first is singing it, when she's walking away. And a lot of the movie, Halloween is, there's the slasher movie going on, but until that point, it's, the story of a lonely smart girl and her two more popular friends. And it's really great how they do this, and no other slasher movie has ever, taken the characters so seriously. And I think that's one of the things about Halloween is that they really took the girls seriously, that you didn't necessarily have to have you could have just had some coming of age movie where she ends up going to the dance the next night with Ben Train, or she doesn't, it could have been Pretty in Pink in 2 days, or something like that. And the first time she's singing the song, Michael's breathing overpowers it. And so when they go through the whole song, I get it, except the problem is it's the same lyrics over and over. So it's not like you missed anything. And that's my issue with it is that it's a cool little close to that scene because it gives you this private moment with Jamie Lee Curtis, yeah, where she's just pausing and reflecting. Or not even, yeah, she's just pausing. Well, that scene also does imply that Michael is following all the girls around, which is cool, but I feel like it's almost like the TV cut, which was made during Halloween 2, works at cross purposes with the idea of Halloween ever having a sequel, which of course is what Carpenter always said, is that, you know, it was never intended to have a sequel. He just wanted some money. And then after a while, he wanted to get his friends some jobs. You know, he got Tommy Lee Wallace a good job directing 3. You know, that was Tommy Lee Wallace's first directorial.
Production designer on this one.
Yeah. And then, what else did I notice this time? Oh,
God. Of course, the future screenwriter of Hook is, of course, The Shape. And speaking of The Shape, like, it's funny how he's credited as The Shape in this one, but not the others. And even in the credits, when they're saying, like, Michael age 6, Michael age 8, or whatever, they still have The Shape for grown-up Michael. There's no, like, you know, just Michael Myers credit.
Right. And then Tony Moran is the Michael age 23, right?
Yeah, he was just for that. Yeah, he was just for that one shot. They didn't want to show Nick Castle's face for some reason until the Big Trouble in Little China music video years later.
The other thing I really noticed this time was sort of Dean Koontz's subjective over the shoulder shots.
Yeah, well, I like how he plays with your expectations, because like the first shot in the movie is this point of view, but then in the rest of the movie, there's shots that seem like their point of view.
And they're not,
Michael Myers, like, steps in from the side.
And that, of course, is something
Carpenter that mashes his fingers on the synth.
That, Sam Raimi really picked that up, this sort of deception. I'm thinking of, he of course, takes it to more outlandish in Evil Dead. There's this shot when Ash is first going down in the basement shot after everybody's dead or whatever. And then you get the long loop and it comes back to Ash's face, even though you thought you started in a POV. Yeah.
It's
a great shot, you know, and it's, you can feel it in this one because, yeah, I mean, Halloween is, I think Halloween, of course, had the Criterion is the first time the TV footage got released, and it was released 4x3 because they were like, that was really funny. I don't know if I told this story at the end of the last episode. Criterion being, I'm going to say 96, 97, and it was pre-DVD. They were the only Laserdisc, elite Laserdisc company there was. There was something called Pioneer Special Editions, but those were mostly just audio commentaries and directors' approved transfers and DP-approved transfers. But Criterion were the ones who were like, no, we know our stuff. We did the research. We're sure of all this stuff we're presenting to you. And they were like, no, it was shot 4x3. It was shot 4x3. And then fast forward about 2 years, and Anchor Bay's like, dude, guess what we found? Panavision TV cut. Guess they were, and they never said guess Criterion was wrong. But at the time,
Carpenter. Yeah, it was plausible. I mean, snooty of them to be definitive.
Right.
But I can't blame them too much for thinking that it wasn't, just because Carpenter had shot TV movies or was shooting them at the same time.
True.
As this,
and especially
Elvis
since,
and Somebody's Watching Me with Warren Hutton.
Especially since, you know, Carpenter never disputed them. But, of course, that's because Carpenter smoked a lot of pot. And,
yeah, he might not have remembered.
But at that point, a lot of the Carpenters came out with commentaries on Laserdisc. So most of your Carpenters are commentaries now are still all from Laserdisc. And it's sort of the whole idea of, was it film school on a disc is Carpenter and Deborah Hill, especially on this one. And, yeah, I mean, Halloween, I love that there's the Hugh, they included this on the Criterion, but I don't think on the Anchor Bay, and I never watched it, even though I did have the Criterion disc at one point. Siskel and Ebert both panned Halloween when it came out, and then did a reevaluation later, where they were like, no, it's actually really good. Because it like hadn't occurred to anyone that these movies could be good. Or something, which is really interesting to me. But I guess it's possible that they weren't able to see Assault on Precinct 13, so they didn't know who Carpenter was.
Well, they wouldn't have judged it on those merits. They would have judged Assault on Precinct 13 like an action movie, and then this was just another horror movie to them. I mean, Ebert was kind of notorious for not liking horror movies, and I don't know. It's just it made a lot of money. It's probably what they had to, why they had to reevaluate it. You know, if anything, but it wasn't really a breakthrough. It definitely was a breakthrough movie, but ironically, it's like the real breakthrough movie might have been Friday the 13th, ripping this off a couple years later, because that was distributed by Paramount. And there's an anecdote in Shock Treatment of, like, you know, Adolf Zukor or whoever saying, or, you know, Mustafa Akkad or something. No, not him. Sean Cunningham. I don't know. But saying to, like, his Hollywood friends, like, you know, they're congratulating him on the success of Friday the 13th. And he's like, guys, you know, we can't be in this game for long, because when the big studios see how much money you can make for a movie like this, which costs so little money, then it's just, you know, the marketplace is going to be flooded. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. And of course, there's the analog today with all the found footage stuff. But,
oh, yeah.
I don't think anybody's going to ever reevaluate.
Halloween was the cheapie of the time. I'm always impressed by how it kind of does look like the Midwest, even though it was shot in Los Angeles.
Yeah, the only thing is,
like, they got bags of dead leaves to throw around. And
they
stuff.
Got bags of dead leaves to throw around, but and then yeah, I was thinking about that because I'm like, they didn't shoot this; they shot this in Southern California. Because I was remembering, you know, the reality of it. And, yeah, unless you pay close attention to the trees, the fact that the leaves on the trees aren't turning.
Right.
Otherwise, right. Yeah. But they did a great job keeping the...
Also, just something about, like, you know, the drab. There's kind of a drabness in the air. Like, it does sort of look like fall.
Right, yeah. And, I mean, I'm sure that's some Dean Koontz magic.
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't know if this is easy to find anymore. Anchor Bay released it. Anchor Bay released it twice. I don't know if Anchor Bay is still releasing the first Halloween. I think somebody else is at this point. But it's cool to watch. I still recommend the theatrical cut over it, just because I feel like if they'd added 20 minutes... it might feel more even, but really, once they stop adding new stuff,
yeah,
the pace is just changed.
I guess maybe it does feel a little like front heavy, and things happen quickly at the end. I mean, they do happen. Like, I hadn't really noticed, but the murders aren't very spaced out. They pretty much happen in the second half of the movie, and that would be the case, even in the theatrical cut. Except for the murder of the sister at the very beginning.
Yeah. So, yeah. I can't believe you listened to this podcast and haven't seen Halloween. So, yeah. I mean, it's like we can't really recommend it. I mean,
television version doesn't disappoint fans. And Halloween fans, you know, they love Halloween too. So, they'll be happy with this also.
Yes.
So, next it's time to talk about The Day After Halloween.
Or Snapshot. Or, hold on, what's it listed on as IMDb? Because I couldn't find it the other day. One more minute.
A line which gains significance at the very end of the film. Unbelievably. First of all, this is Australian. Second of all, it's not cool just because it's Australian. It's actually quite dull. Excruciatingly dull, in fact.
Well... So I was in the pre-show. You accused me of coming up with this movie, which I guess is possible. Maybe I did come up with it.
I think it's because we were talking about, like, your some you know, service he had found to get movies from very obscure origins, including
I believe
he described it as an Australian sequel, an Australian unofficial sequel to Halloween.
Oh God, you're right. This was a long time ago. I probably did. That place is going out of business probably because they bought 4,000 copies of this on DVD and
oh
went bankrupt.
God, yeah.
To resell them in the U.S. So I was okay with it because I'm like, well, it's Simon Winsor, you know, Simon Winsor, who's directed tons and tons of crap, but he has a certain amount of journeyman respect because he did Lonesome Dove and he did Quigley Down Under. I've never seen Lonesome Dove. Harley Davidson in the Marlboro Man, which we sat through.
Which we've done on the show.
And I would actually say his direction of this is not terrible. He's okay. No. I mean, the problem is the script is freaking terror, and it's also a disco thriller full of drag queens and evil lesbians, and it's incredible.
It's a thriller where only two people die, and at the very end of the movie, and that's the best kind of thriller.
Yeah, okay.
Especially if the plot is full of boring and uninteresting and self-absorbed characters, and this idiotic heroine who poses nude for a magazine and is drawn into the seedy underworld of nude photography.
She doesn't just pose nude for a magazine. She poses
Is for a cologne ad, but they use a topless shot of her, and I don't know if it's different in Australia, but her whole deal is like, you said you weren't going to show my face, and we can see who it is, and
yeah.
That's like not even until I think about halfway through the movie, and it's an hour and 40 minutes, and things really
it's really long
at a crawl.
It's really long because I was like, I forgot how much was added to Halloween. So I was like, nah, Halloween's 90 minutes. It'll be fine. And this one, I'm like, holy shit. It's a slasher movie. That's, you know, 100 minutes. They're not supposed to make those. And it's not a slasher movie. It opens with, okay. So let's try and, set the tone in 1980. You're going to the movies in a bad neighborhood, probably, and you're like, well, what should I see? And you see a sign that says The Day After Halloween. And hell, maybe you heard they're making another Halloween and you don't know anything because IMDb doesn't exist yet. So you go see this fucking movie. And then in the opening scene, when there's firemen putting shit out, you're kind of like, huh.
So yeah.
The entire movie is told in flashback because the only reason you're worried about the lead character is because you think she dies because you think they found her burned up corpse in the first scene. And here, we didn't spoil anything in Halloween, so we always spoil something. I'm going to spoil Snapshot for you. The lead character doesn't die. Her psycho lesbian friend kills all the people around her or something so that she can kidnap her and run off with her to evil lesbian bliss. It's really weird in that regard because the bad guys are getting on this girl about her friendship with this woman. And so you're like, oh, okay, so they're small-minded dipshits, right? Her mom is this evil Christian lady. Her ex-boyfriend is like a junior pederast or something. Her sister is even worse. I mean, her sister, I was like, are they going to kill the sister? That might make the movie worth it.
How funny is that? It's like that inexplicable moment where like she sees her little sister with ice cream because the ice cream truck drove off. And then the little girl and her friend both like throw the cones that they just bought on the ground so they can smoke a cigarette.
And so
it's pretty unintentionally funny.
That was actually like one of the nicest scenes in my opinion, because there's that great shot of the lead character. Oh God, her name's Angela. There's a whole song about her growing up and being confused by life.
It happens during the montage of her having that cologne ad photographed.
Right. half of Snapshot, more than half probably, is like a TV movie about moving to the big city. It really yeah. is. There's
it does
a,
have a very TV movie vibe to it.
There's Tim Daly's in it. It's from 84. He's in love with a ballerina, and she goes to New York, and it's like the first thing he did after Diner, and I saw it years ago, like many, many years ago. It's the same fucking movie. It's, you know, fame has ruined her, or, you know, it's the story of somebody getting famous or thinking they're getting famous. The other problem is the timeline. She's supposed to pay rent on a weekly basis, yet they refer to it as a monthly visitor. It's very strange. But that scene, I don't want to dismiss this one scene. There's a great shot of the lead character. It's a long shot, and I'm like, it was the shot where I was like, you know, Simon Winsor's not bad. This movie just fucking sucks. Like, his setups aren't bad. It's interesting enough looking, even though the final chase scene's terrible. But the initial setup, a lot of his direction's not bad. He can't direct thriller scenes to save his life, and the scenes when they're out nightclubbing are awful. But, you know, the Australia in the late 70s stuff, it's not terrible. I thought it was, you know, I don't know, a nice travel log. You could cut an okay 34-second travel log.
I mean, it seems pretty low budget, and then also... it's just not exciting in the least bit. I mean, I think they even mentioned this movie in that not quite Hollywood Aussie exploitation movie documentary, and it just gets like a cursory mention. But the other movies they show in that documentary are really exciting, and this just has, well, I guess we should talk about the one Australian, you know, film history item of note to us besides Simon Winsor, is that the photographer who introduces Angela to this life of
debauchery.
Life of debauchery is the toe cutter.
The toe cutter,
Mad Max,
at the same year. The same
the
year.
The opening chase.
No. Opening chase is Knight Rider. Toe cutter's the main villain.
Oh, you're right. It's
Knight
Rider.
So
yeah.
You're like, and he's this. He's one of the suspects because he photographs dead things, but he was good. He was actually pretty good, and I was staring at him.
If you ever want to see the Knight Rider
in
a dramatic role, this is it. If you've wanted to see his floozy, his skag, who's gonna die, Lulu Pinkerton or whatever, she's also in this fashion model skanks who Angela is cavorting with.
Because that's one of the things. They shack up. Angela gets kicked out of her house. Angela's the lead character. And she's not terrible. She's just in a TV movie. I mean, that's like the real problem with this is that it's not scary. And the guy who made... I read some of the trivia on it because I had commented to you, I think... that I thought it was famous because I thought it was famous in Australia because they actually released a soundtrack. Well, they released a soundtrack because it's Brian May, not the guy from Queen, but the guy who scored Mad Max and maybe even Road Warrior.
And the Road Warrior and some other. Yeah, he's a really good composer.
But not here.
Well, I was thinking actually in many scenes, like, boy, if it weren't for Brian May music right now, this would be like unbearable to watch. My eyeballs would be like jumping out of their sockets to get away. Nothing is happening. Like, people, this is one of those movies full of shots where people just walk across rooms, you know, to pick up
a lot
the phone
of that, a lot of
something.
That stuff. Well, okay, so the producer apparently had a lot of success with his previous thriller, and it was directed by Richard Franklin. Who
is that? Patrick?
Yeah, Patrick.
Right, which is like actually like a well-regarded kind of horror movie. I haven't seen it either. It's actually got a good reputation, unlike this movie, which nobody's heard of.
Yeah, and Richard Patrick has a pretty good reputation with us because of Halloween 2. Not Halloween 2, Psycho 2.
Right, and Richard Franklin actually... It's one of those directors who, like, I would really like to see the movies of his that I haven't seen.
Right.
Like Road Games. And I don't know if he did Razorback. Probably not.
No, Razorback was Mulcahy.
Yeah, but he's this Australian genre guy, basically.
So then they made this one, and it's, you know, supposed to be a Hitchcockian thing. And, I mean, it's not, because it's a piece of shit. But I just thought that was very interesting that, you know, it was Richard Franklin got his start with this producer, and then the producer's next movie was this thing. And Simon Windsor, I don't think he's ever returned to horror. Like I said, the guy, he did Lonesome Dove, which, regardless of whatever, it's a TV miniseries. It can't be that great. I mean, no TV miniseries are that great. It's a problem with the format. But Quigley Down Under was pretty cool. But Quigley Down Under also has the, you know, political message that it's about mistreatment of Aboriginals, and it's got Alan Rickman as a good villain. Anyway, so I was actually not as down on this going into it as I could have been, but oh shit, within 4 minutes I sure was. I mean, in the opening shots, you know, I'm like, wow, I might be interested in this because the fire trucks in Australia are weird. Like, that's about all there is to this movie, is you're like, wow, it's like a snapshot into what Australia was like in the 70s.
You figured it out.
There's nothing else. There's nothing else for it. But I don't actually remember what the 1 minute later, one more minute.
Oh, because when you find out when the real killer, I can't even say the real killer because nobody has even died in this movie up to this point. That's the thing, is that like the girl gets stalked by this guy only. Not really, because everything is so slow. And
she's actually not stalked by a guy.
People close to her or anything. He puts a pig's head in her bed that she discovers.
I heard he spoiled this.
And like those are supposed to be the big shock scenes. And it's really, there's no body count whatsoever. Oh, but the one more minute line is because the killer has revealed himself, and he's babbling something about how when people realize they have, you know, one more minute left to die.
Oh shit, you're
They'll
right.
Do anything they can to prolong the inevitable or something like that. It's not Snapshot's a better title. Not that it matters with this movie, which you shouldn't watch under any title.
No. But what's interesting is what you're talking about, the killer you're talking about, because I guess, well, there's a attempted murderer and arsonist, and then there's a killer. Would that be a better way of describing
it? Turns out there's two killers at the end.
So the killer you're talking about in the U.S. cut that came out as Day After Halloween, I was reading in the trivia that they removed his context from the movie entirely.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. I'm gonna spoil it even more. So the killer Matt's talking about is this wacky movie director. Who is obsessing about Angela after she's been topless in the cold water. And so he has a studio set up at apparently a major motion picture studio, but he has a little studio set up that's layered with her picture. And all I could think was, wasn't his assistant who was layering these pictures wondering what the fuck he or she was doing? He is the husband of Angela's best friend, who's just come on to her, and Angela has rejected her lesbian advances. Well, then we find out that actually the best friend was the real stalker? Yeah.
Yeah, the real stalker.
And that she did it all so she could basically kidnap Angela.
And she drives the ice cream truck that we've been seeing stalk Angela into the guy.
The ice cream truck man. The ice cream man.
Yeah.
Where the hell was I going with this? It's so dumb I can't even think about it. Yeah, I mean, it's just... Oh, okay, yeah, the U.S. cut removed the fact it was her husband.
Oh.
So it's like, it was just some dude that she introduced her to, much like the toe cutter. When she introduces her to the toe cutter and she's like, you're going to make her famous, right? Because Angela's apparently a bad hairstylist otherwise. And if you hear the song Angela, which you probably either have at the beginning of this episode or will at the end of this episode, because, oh shit, I found it. you listen to it and you think you're watching a fucking, what was the name of that? Christy McNichol movie. You think you're watching the fucking movie where Christy McNichol's a figure skater and she loses her, the use of her legs, and she meets some dude and she doesn't know if he's ever going to love her, blah, 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 and it's her fucking song. That's what you're going to think when you hear this song. But it's not that. It's this shitty...
Have to call it a thriller, technically.
I don't want to call it a thriller. It doesn't seem right. Halloween 4 is a thriller. Friday the 13th 4 is more of a thriller.
You can't call it a mystery, really.
No, because it's not... Well, the problem with the movie is that the lead character is not inherently likable. The reason we're supposed to care about her is because her life is in danger. We think she's going to die. We think it's some sort of retroactive necrophilia, like looking at her. But that doesn't... When you remove the bookend, or not even the bookend, when you remove the flashback device from the first scene, you have this boring story of a bitchy late hairdresser who quits her job, takes her shirt off, gets famous, but only for a second, has tons of money problems, has a mother who's like pimping her out to some psychotic ice cream truck driver,
Yeah, maybe the subtext is supposed to be that... she tries to escape the homosexuals at her place of employ, like her gay hairdresser boss, only to find, you know, lesbians in the photography world, and she, you know, it's a mess. maybe the subtext that the movie tries to have is about gays in our society.
On one hand, I would actually say that I have not seen very many American movies from 1979, 1980, 1981 that really dealt with having gay people in the movie without, even though, of course, the lesbian is the psycho at the end, for the majority of the runtime, it's just this implied sort of, not even a subplot, it's just a character trait. They don't make a big deal out of it until the end. And I guess that would be one thing that I would wonder about is that indicative of Australian... I mean, it's not French, for God's sake. If it was French, I'd be like, well, shit, you guys weren't doing this in 1952? Like, come on, you guys are behind the times. But it does seem in some ways a little bit more... Until the end, when it's a psycho lesbian killer... a little more sensitive than American movies, or at least acknowledging of the situation.
Well, there is also the, flamboyant, pasty makeup.
Oh, good God, that fucking
singer
scene.
Guy who kind of looks like Barry Humphries, another Australian who likes to do drag. The Australians like drag comedy
apparently they like it a lot.
And he just sings these unfunny novelty songs to this nightclub crowd who just loves him, and I guess he's supposed to be gay, or you know,
I was
he's supposed to be a part
too.
Of that world.
That was pretty awful.
And it's just like it's just so much filler too. They just like turn they give him close ups and just let the camera run on him. Maybe this movie's full of filler because Simon Windsor knew how little story there was, but then it turned out being too long.
I think I got off track earlier. It was a bomb in Australia. It was a hit overseas, probably because they released it as the day after Halloween.
Speaking of the day after Halloween, I'm trying to think of like how I would react if I went into this as a Halloween fan then, and what I saw. And it's like when we did Alien and Alien
right.
2 on Earth, like you were asking, like. Do Italians and the Spanish people go into these ripoff sequels, and do they know that what they're going in for, that it's going to be a ripoff sequel, like an unofficial one, and they're just like used to that? Because you go in and you see this, and maybe you start justifying it in your own head, like, okay, obviously it's nobody from Halloween, but you've got this young girl who at the beginning they're trying to say like, oh, she's, you know, you're so shy, you need to get yourself out there. It's like, you know, Lori's friends cajoling her about that. And then she's targeted by a guy who drives around stalking her. Michael Myers drove around in Halloween. I mean, this is the kind of tortured logic I'd be going through to try to like justify sitting through the movie after I had bought my ticket and seeing it as some kind of sequel on any thematic plane, you know?
And, you know, not to discount that, a lot of people do that. I mean, if you ever worked at a video store, you know people come in and they tell you, well, I think that was a sequel to that. And you're just kind of like shaking your head because just because Bruce Willis is in the movie doesn't mean that, you know, Striking Distance is Die Hard 3. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, it's... we got done. I mean, basically what we talked about the last half of the show, the first half of the show, got to be a lot about the technical expertise and all the amazing things that Carpenter and Dean Koontz did on Halloween. You watch Snapshot, and I don't think Simon Winsor ever saw Halloween.
No.
I don't think his DP ever saw, I don't know, any movie ever shot. I think his DP only grew up on BBC TV movies because it could just be the transfer. I mean, nobody preserved this thing, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But
the DP is
not good.
Like, it's the fact that it's not a slasher, it just kind of points to how bad an idea the movie is because, like, the script isn't any good, and you could really easily imagine this being a slasher movie with a body count where these other models around Angela are getting bumped off by her stalker.
Exactly.
But, like, somehow the producers of this movie just didn't see the change in the genre that Halloween pointed towards, so they just let this really boring movie get made.
I'm giving the
benefit of the doubt that other movies that this production company put out were not so dull because Patrick is well-regarded.
She lives in a house of... Well, they're not really art hippies because they all are in... they're all in the modeling industry. They're in the low-brow modeling. Not even low-brow. I mean, it's a good ad. Honestly, the ad that they come up with, that's a good ad. I mean, like, that's cool. Like, you know, in the scene where they shoot the picture, it's got the crappy song going, but it's technically cool. I'm sure Simon Winsor shot a cologne ad in his previous career because this was his first movie. But she lives in a house with all these annoying roommates. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to see a bunch of them get killed. But they go out. Yeah, I mean it's just the
Without
scary
that,
part
there's
is
just, there's just nothing.
It's they make a big deal or the press that gets reprinted now and the quotes that get reprinted on Wikipedia now talk about how it was so low budget. Yet you watch it and it's clearly got a higher budget than Halloween. Exchange rates, whatever. It's got a higher budget than Halloween. It's got more daytime shooting. It's got more actors. It's got more locations. It's got to have had a higher budget comparatively to Halloween. You couldn't have thrown some bodies in there for that? I mean, did they waste it all on calling out the fire department for the opening scene?
Yeah.
I guess there are pyrotechnics that Halloween wouldn't have had.
There's a guy on fire on the end, just at the end, just like Halloween 2. Michael Myers is on fire at the end. I'm still reaching here. Still stretching.
Nobody discusses... there's no Donald Pleasance analog. I mean, I did mention this, that, you know, Halloween feels like it's a coming-of-age movie split with a thriller. Snapshot feels like it's a coming-of-age movie split with a doesn't know what the hell to do with it. And they think they can call it a thriller because they end up having a body in it. It's less of a slasher movie knockoff and more of a terrible, terrible Hitchcock knockoff in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's true. That's true.
But I did want to mention that, so this is from 79. Because I assume the terrible website where I discovered this freaking movie.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, Ozploitation, which sort of ended in the 80s, in the early 80s. It sort of ended with Mad Max. I don't think Road Warrior is considered Ozploitation. And I've never seen any Ozploitation except for this. The terrible website also had a lot of other Australian movies, which I ended up seeing. And so what's interesting is that I would say 2 years from, well, not 2 years, but 3 years, by 90 or by 82. And I'm just going off of the one movie that I can think of that I still have a stop button post up for. The Australians had changed tone quite a bit because they actually had, a lot better actors, and they got a lot more thoughtful directors, and they got what's the name of that lady? Let me look her up real quick. What's her name?
I'm not sure.
I'm gonna get it. I'm gonna get it. She, Gillian Armstrong, by the mid to late 80s, was making all these really, actually, she went to the U.S. and then came back to Australia. But anyway, she started in 79 with My Brilliant Career, which I have not seen. But the Australians started making important movies, actually, for women in a lot of ways. My Brilliant Career with Judy Davis. High Tide is Judy Davis and her daughter. Basically, it was, the Australians were on a regular basis making movies that in the United States would have only been made if Meryl Streep wasn't busy that mm-hmm. week.
Yeah.
And so this was the end of Ozploitation, where you would have, and the woman, the evil lesbian lady, she's not even, doesn't even give that bad of a performance. She's kind of okay, but she's a soap opera actress. You know, the lead is like a soap opera actress or a TV movie actress. They're not very good. It wouldn't matter if they were, because the script's so crappy. You know, the last 8 years of American cinema has showed you, no matter how good an actor is, the shitty script is gonna hurt him. It's sort of interesting as being at that point just before Australian cinema got serious.
But it's not of really historic interest, perhaps, and nothing
it's a footnote
that doesn't require you to see it.
It does not require you to see it, but apparently you can quite easily. You can probably see this movie easier than you can see the Halloween TV cut.
Yeah, or I Married a Witch, for that matter, which is a much better movie to watch around Halloween, or the day after Halloween, or the day after Halloween.
We really should have just done that. We should have just gone right back into talking about how great I Married a Witch is, instead of doing this.
It can't be overstated how good that movie is.
But I believe it's actually on TV. We're a month late now mentioning that, but I believe I Married a Witch is now in regular rotation on TCM.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah, so that's good news for everyone, because you're not seeing Snapshot. Toe Cutter. I'm going to interrupt. If you are a big Mad Max fan, you actually see.
Not a reason. I mean,
it kind of is.
I think less of the Knight Rider now, frankly.
Turn it off. Turn it off after halfway, but at least see the guy, because I don't feel. I assume he went on to Australian TV, but anyway. Yes, I'm sorry for interrupting. Let's go with the next episode, which cannot be as bad as this. Well,
no. We're changing gears to comedy, everybody. Laughs and yucks with Chevy Chase as Fletch in Fletch. And Fletch Lives, the sequel. It's a great example of a sequel that just kills a franchise, like, instantly. And yeah, I quite like Fletch. It's probably my only favorite. It's my only Chevy Chase movie that I really enjoy, besides maybe like National Lampoon's Vacation or Caddyshack. But he's almost more like an ensemble player in those. This is a leading man. I know you're a big fan of Foul Play, and I've heard that's really good.
I am. But yes.
In any case, being charming and running around and stuff is Chevy Chase. So we're watching the original and the sequel in the next episode.
Yes.
And I can think of one more reason to watch Snapshot. It's more likely that there are some deranged fans of the Knight Rider's girl, Lulu Pinkerton, I think. And if they need to see a little more of her, she's in this as Wendy, Angela's pal. But
who?
Yeah, keep that fast forward button handy.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know who that is, and I just watched the movie.
Well, you know, she's the girl who is with the Knight Rider in that opening.
Well, I know that who that is, but I don't know who she is in this. And I don't even remember the character named Wendy. Possibly because Angela was so unlikable that I didn't think of her having friends.
Everybody is so unlikable in Snapshot that they all just kind of blend into each other. But yeah, the girl from the same scene in Mad Max.
Which is the same year. Well. Yeah, I mean...
For completists only.
Completists only, yes. Sadly, Halloween TV cut should not be. So try and find that in your dollar bin. Because Anchor Bay did release a single disc pressing of it. So that'd be cool to see.
All right, so for an Alan Smithy podcast, this has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
And we hope you had a spooktacular Halloween, everyone. Thanks for listening.